of the House Republicans' plan would also use tax credits, but they would calculate those tax credits in a different way.
On Capitol Hill, House Republicans release their proposed changes to the Affordable Care Act. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Bill Walker announces his plans to combat the state's increasing opioid crisis.
There's many other things that we are working on, but this is one that is, we believe, quite significant.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
Republicans in the U.S. House today released a plan to replace former President Barack Obama's signature health care law. The new plan would phase out the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid. That may be a deal killer for several Senate Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski. The House proposal offers tax credits to help people buy insurance if they don't get it through their jobs. But as APRN Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, those tax credits are far less generous to Alaskans than the subsidies in existing law.
Under the Affordable Care Act, what we have now, a middle-income Alaskan who buys a policy on healthcare.gov gets more of a subsidy than somebody of the same age with the same income who lives in, say, Reno, Nevada, where insurance is cheaper.
Yeah, so people in Alaska get pretty big tax credits under the Affordable Care Act, and that's for a couple of reasons.
Cynthia Cox is a policy researcher at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
First of all, the tax credits are tied to how much premiums cost in a given area, and Alaska just happens to have very high health insurance premiums compared to the rest of the country.
The other factor in how tax credits are calculated under the Affordable Care Act is income relative to the poverty line, which is set higher in Alaska. In all, some 18,000 Alaskans bought policies through healthcare.gov last year. They received nearly $146 million in tax credits. The credits are often described as subsidies. Same thing, Cox says.
What most people think of as the financial help that people are getting when they shop on healthcare.gov, those are actually tax credits under the Affordable Care Act. And so the House Republicans' plan would also use tax credits, but they would calculate those tax credits in a different way.
Under the Republican proposal, the amount of tax credit would be the same in all parts of the country, though it would vary by age. So consider the tax credits for a 60-year-old man in Fairbanks who earns $50,000 a year. He's eligible for about $20,000 in tax credits, covering most of the premium for a silver-level Affordable Care Act plan. Under the House Republican plan, his tax credits would drop to $4,000 a year. And a 60-year-old in low-cost Reno, Nevada, he'd also receive $4,000 a year in tax credits under the Republican plan. Younger people would get less. Under the Affordable Care Act, the average tax credit for an eligible Alaskan is $9,000 per year. Of course, tax credits aren't the whole story. Under the Affordable Care Act, the individual mandate requires people to buy substantial coverage, and those policies cost more. Cox says that's one of the big trade-offs and criticisms of the ACA. She says a person could save money under the Republican plan by buying bare bones coverage in some states.
So that might mean that you pay less for your premium, but when you go to the doctor or you have a hospital stay, you would pay more out of pocket.
Alaska Governor Bill Walker was at the White House recently and met with Health Secretary Tom Price. One thing Walker says he pushed to get across is that health care isn't the same across every state.
And how in some places you might take an ambulance 3 miles. In Alaska, you'll take a you call for 911 with a medevac of some sort, could be you know tens of thousands of dollars. So it's just it's a different situation in Alaska than it is in Lower 48.
Alaska's U.S. senators say they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which they say isn't working for Alaska. But they've also said they don't want to pull the rug out from under Alaskans who rely on it. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A new state bill is aimed at curbing opioid addiction and overdose deaths. The bill lets patients tell healthcare providers and hospitals to not give them opioids. It also requires healthcare providers receive training in opioid addiction. Governor Bill Walker introduced the bill.
It's not the be-all and end-all. There's many paths to recovery. There's many other things that we are working on, but this is one that is, we believe, quite significant.
The bill also limits initial opioid prescriptions to a 7-day supply. The measure requires pharmacists and veterinarians to register their prescriptions in a database that would be updated daily instead of weekly if the bill passes. Doctors and nurses who prescribe opioids would be required to check that database, and prescribers would get a report card from the State Board of Pharmacy indicating how frequently they prescribe opioids compared with similar providers. Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson says another important piece of treating addiction is the state's Medicaid expansion. It's added health coverage for 30,000 Alaskans.
Every one of us in this room knows somebody. We're related to somebody. We have some connection to somebody who is struggling with opioid addiction. And I would encourage you that if you think that's not true, I would encourage you to look a little bit harder.
Walker introduced the bill at a press conference today in which he announced other opioid-related measures. The state will begin giving prison inmates with addictions the medication Vivitrol. It helps them overcome addiction by blocking the effects of opioid drugs. The House and Senate versions of the bill were referred to the Health and Social Services and Finance Committees. The federal agency overseeing the ongoing gas leak in Cook Inlet has said the responsible company must shut down the pipeline if it's not fixed by May 1st. In a March 3rd letter to Hillcorp, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration also said the leak likely started in late December. Hillcorp has 30 days to contest the findings in the proposed safety order from the agency. The company first reported the gas leak in early February. Hillcorp says dangerous ice conditions in Cook Inlet mean the company likely can't send divers to fix the pipeline until mid to late March. The leak is coming from a fuel line and is releasing between 210,000 and 310,000 cubic feet of gas per day. Both regulators and the company say shutting off the flow of gas could lead to an oil spill because the fuel line was once used to carry oil. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has raised concerns about environmental impacts that could be associated with the leak. The state is also fining Hillcorp $200,000 for a 2015 incident that nearly killed three workers on the North Slope. That's a significant reduction from the $720,000 penalty the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission proposed last year. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration received a surprise on Friday. The Trump administration is proposing deep cuts to the organization, which focuses on fisheries and climate science. As reported in the Washington Post, NOAA could lose 26% of its overall budget. The Sea Grant program, with more than a dozen projects in Alaska, could be hit particularly hard. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
This is the wildest ride I ever remember.
Carol Kaner is a communication specialist at Sea Grant. She's worked there for about 25 years. And last week, she found out that the organization could lose all of its federal funding by scrolling through Facebook.
Part of the reason I've worked here so long is that I believe in this program. I think it's an excellent program, and I've loved my work here, and I've felt like it made a difference. And that's a big thing.
Sea Grant helps train villages to monitor coastal erosion, tracks the economic vitality of the seafood industry, and studies the impact of climate change, among many, many other things. The organization supports research at 33 universities nationwide, including the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Kaner says Sea Grant plays a vital role nationally and in the state, so the news that the Trump administration wanted to eliminate the program was hard to swallow.
I was thinking this is crazy. Sea Grant has such a huge return on investment, why would you cut a program that gives you a major return on investment if you're trying to grow the economy?
NOAA is administered by the U.S. Department of Commerce. The Washington Post obtained a memo that said the new administration wants to, quote, prioritize rebuilding the military. It mentions the trade-offs and choices inherent in pursuing the goals. Paula Kullenberg, the Alaska director of Sea Grant, says she's not sure why the program didn't make the cut.
I have no idea. Maybe this was an easy mark and it was something on a spreadsheet that looked available. I don't think that there was, as far as I know, there wasn't any in-depth analysis.
Sea Grant has been in Alaska for about 47 years, and Kullenberg says the program has been threatened before. She says the Reagan administration tried to nix the funding, but Congress chose to reinstate it. This time around, she hopes it goes the same way.
You know, it feels like a bit of a blow. It feels like a bit of a lack of confidence, for sure, but or a lack of support by the administration. But so I can't really say that I'm confident, but I'm certainly hopeful.
The White House and lawmakers will have the upcoming months to decide. Kullenberg is meeting with NOAA this week in Washington, D.C. to discuss a game plan. The next fiscal year starts in October. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, it's Iditarod time, and for one Chicago teacher, that means being prepared.
My job is to fly out on the trail in little planes and report back to classrooms across the country.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Mushers are on the rivers heading out of Fairbanks right now as the 45th Iditarod starts in earnest. This is the second time in three races that the restart has been held in Fairbanks. And as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, a lot of the mushers have vivid memories of the 2015 race, so this year they're trying to pack accordingly.
It was chilly in Fairbanks, with overnight lows dipping towards 30 below. But by the time mushers were harnessing dogs and running through checklists, the clear weather was easing towards a balmy 0 degrees. Though not running the race this year, four-time winner Lance Mackey was on hand and says this year's serious winter in the interior may prove a strong factor to contend with.
The wind has been blowing all winter. It snows when least expected. And I think it's going to be, I've said many times, if these people haven't tried their snowshoes on, they're going to be hurting, because I think this is a year that you might need them, even to get off the trail to camp.
Trailbreakers have been adding passing lanes to the early part of the route heading toward Tanana, where the snows have been the heaviest. Long stretches in the first leg of the race will require most mushers to stop between checkpoints, a break to feed and rest the dogs. All around the parking lot that's been converted to a dog yard, mushers are attaching bales of straw to their sleds, some on the baskets. Others, like veteran Pete Kaiser, were piling it into trailers hitched behind the sled.
This just gives a little extra room for some of these long runs between checkpoints where we're going to be stopping on the trail and camping, and requires you to haul a little more gear. So
what will not be hauled in the trailer this year is dogs. A controversial rule change bars mushers from carrying dogs in trailers, throwing a wrench in many people's strategies from years past, which involved regularly rotating animals through rest to long runs. But many people are experimenting with a workaround, most notably returning champion Dallas Seavey.
And so without being able to carry dogs in trailers, we had to find a way to bridge that gap. So we just made a bigger sled.
Seavey is standing over what looks like the Batmobile of dog sleds. It's almost totally black. And instead of an external frame with a bag suspended from supports, this looks more like a plastic shell. It's about 10% bigger than a regular sled. He had it custom built from Kevlar and carbon fiber and mounted to the runners behind where the musher stands is another heavy-duty cube that could hold supplies or dogs. Because according to the rules, as long as it's safe and fixed to the structure of the primary sled, you can use it for animals.
There's many sleds here that have the ability to carry just as many dogs as I do in the same way. They just don't have hard sides. I like the hard sides because it helps protect the dogs so that, you know, if there's just a piece of fabric between them and the great big world, you know, it's a little less than a carbon fiber and Kevlar. You know, I've got them in a, you know, a little cocoon in there.
Hundreds of people took buses from the Carlson Center to view the event at Pike's Landing. Spectators lined the long chute, clapping as mushers rushed below celebratory arches, down onto the Chena River and on toward Nome. In Fairbanks, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Iditarod Trail won't be full of just mushers. A teacher will be following along as part of a yearly program. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early caught up with this year's teacher on the trail before she took off on Iditarod 2017.
For 2 years, Annie Kelly of St. Andrew's School in Chicago has been preparing for a new type of lesson plan.
My job is to fly out on the trail in little planes and report back to classrooms across the country that are using Iditarod as a teaching tool.
Kelly found out she was a finalist for the Teacher on the Trail program in January of last year. And just as mushers have extensive preparation on the Iditarod with years of planning, training, and work, so too does Kelly. Between an application process that required letters of recommendation and long-term lesson planning, she says the experience has been nonstop.
So since I was selected as teacher on the trail, I've been keeping a website, and that has tons of lessons that I've been doing with my kids in Chicago, and I share it with teachers across the country. And I've been presenting at a couple conferences, and just getting my cold gear weather clothes ready. Chicago did not prepare me well this year. It was a very mild, mild winter there.
For Kelly, getting ready for the weather means more than a hat and gloves.
I think four layers on the bottom, top with some heavy-duty L.L. Bean snow pants, boots that go down to negative 100, and there'll be feet warmers in those boots. Probably four layers on top with a parka. That was well-tested at the Junior Iditarod. Giant hat and like four pairs of gloves, and I'll probably only be wearing two at each time, but I've got lots of gloves and hand and feet warmers will be used at all times.
While this is the first and probably only time Kelly will be teacher on the trail, she says back in Chicago, she loves incorporating the Iditarod into lesson plans for her fourth graders.
So my lessons, a lot of them revolve around language arts. We write letters to the mushers, so writing friendly letters, and a lot of times they'll write back, which is really fun. My favorite is one year, one of the rookie mushers hand wrote a letter to my student front backside of a sheet of loose leaf, and it was just so cool that he took the time to do that.
While Kelly will be reporting to her students on all of the mushers, she said she has a couple favorites.
You know, I have a few favorites. Charlie Baina is a musher from Chicago, and so he's come into my classroom, and it's been really awesome. And Allie Zirkel, girl power, I'm excited to see her come in at the finish. And those are two that I'm rooting for.
And Kelly's students are just as excited as she is for the opportunity.
They've been hearing about it for about 2 years now, this whole process. The biggest thing is just keep warm, Miss Kelly, is all they tell me, and be safe. I had one student write me a card, and it said, if you're afraid of heights and small little planes, don't worry, you're the teacher on the trail. You're not scared of anything.
The last great race formally started today in Fairbanks, and Ms. Kelly will be reporting to teachers across the country every step of the way on the Iditarod website. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The state Senate today unanimously passed a bill that would make October 25th African-American soldiers' contribution to building the Alaska Highway Day. The bill, introduced by Wasilla Republican David Wilson, was created in conjunction with the 75th anniversary of the construction of the highway. Wilson says he feels little recognition has been given to the African-American soldiers who helped to build the highway with the Army Corps of Engineers. About a third of the soldiers who built the highway were African-American. In a time of segregation and overt racism, Wilson called the highway project, quote, one of the first bridges to civil rights. The bill has now moved to the House.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely.
Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 tons, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Fairbanks Four were released 2 years ago. It took the work of journalists, lawyers, tribal leaders, and citizens. Now there is an effort underway to compensate the men for the 18 years they spent in prison, convicted on a murder charge and other serious crimes. KTOO's Caroline Halter reports.
On December 17, 2015, hundreds gathered at the Chief David Salmon Tribal Hall in Fairbanks to celebrate the release of the Fairbanks Four.
Supporting us and our families. I'm gonna let the boys talk, but we're home!
That night, three of the four men were released. The fourth, Marvin Roberts, was released on parole the summer before. Bill Oberle is the attorney who led the effort to free the Fairbanks Four.
Don't let the door hit you in the rear end on the way out is all they got for their 18 years of wrongful conviction.
After it was all over, he became involved in an effort to give permanent fund dividends back to the four men for the time they spent behind bars.
It seems only fair that the dividends that were taken away from them wrongfully should be provided to them and give them a little monetary help trying to restart their lives.
I called Marvin Roberts to ask him what he thinks.
I realize now, after being away for so long, how valuable being with family is, and receiving all those back dividends would just, I'd just be so happy. I'd be able to see my family. I'd be able to maybe start my own business. I'd be able to stay ahead of my bills. I mean, it would help out a lot. I'm looking at my baby right now. She's in her little jumpers.
Roberts lives in Fairbanks. He has two jobs. He works at a company that makes and installs granite countertops during the week and delivers pizza on the weekends. His daughter is 6 months old. Last year, Oberle's effort to get dividends paid to the Fairbanks Four didn't really go anywhere. He's hopeful that this year will be different. In Juneau, I'm Caroline Halter.
For the past 6 months, the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly has debated whether it should restrict who gives the opening prayer at each assembly meeting. Several years ago, a lawsuit over prayer in public meetings consumed a town in upstate New York, eventually making its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. KBBI's Shayla Farzan reports.
Nearly a decade ago, Greece made national headlines when two residents sued the city over the prayer that begins each town board meeting. They allege the invocations, though technically open to all faiths, were almost exclusively Christian. Linda Stevens was one of the plaintiffs. The retired school librarian has lived in Greece for over 40 years, but when she first filed the lawsuit, she says she felt like an outsider in her own community.
I had a lot of unpleasant things happen to me. My house was vandalized a couple of times, and I was accosted in public a time or two, and in fact, my neighbor told me one day that I should move out of town.
Stevens identifies as an atheist, and her co-plaintiff, Susan Galloway, is Jewish. For years, the Greece Town Board had observed a moment of silence before their monthly meetings. But in 1999, the board replaced it with an opening prayer given by local clergy. Town employees selected the chaplains of the month by calling congregations within city limits. Because the churches in Greece are almost entirely Christian, the vast majority of invocations were as well. Americans United for Separation of Church and State represented the plaintiffs in the case. Robert Goldstein is the president of the organization's Rochester chapter.
We thought there was an important principle that had to do with the extent to which a local governing body can engage in activities which encourage one particular religious denomination to the exclusion of others.
But the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the town, setting a legal precedent for prayer in public meetings. Brett Harvey serves as senior counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom, the Christian legal organization that represented Greece in the lawsuit. He says the Supreme Court ruling states that towns are not obligated to ensure a diversity of religions are represented if it means looking beyond the boundaries of their communities.
The question is, does the government have an obligation to allow anyone and everyone access to their microphone?
That same question, who can give an invocation, is at the heart of a lawsuit between the Kenai Peninsula Borough and the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. The borough instituted an invocation policy last summer after Iris Fontana, a member of the Satanic Temple and one of three plaintiffs in the case, gave an invocation ending with the words, "Hail Satan." Under the new policy, a religious association that meets regularly in the borough can nominate a representative to give the invocation. The policy is similar to the one the town of Greece adopted after the Supreme Court ruling. But the ACLU of Alaska is suing the borough, saying the policy violates the right to free speech.
The kind of policy that the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly has implemented is not of a kind that the Supreme Court has upheld as being constitutionally permissible.
That's ACLU attorney Eric Glatt speaking at a press conference in December. Alliance Defending Freedom, the same organization that represented the town of Greece, is now representing the borough pro bono. Records show the borough has spent over $18,000 on legal and administrative costs related to the invocation policy. The lawsuit against the borough has moved to state court, but a trial date has yet to be scheduled. Back in the town of Greece, although Linda Stevens lost the case, she says having a written invocation policy in place has created a more inclusive atmosphere in the town board meetings.
From my point of view, things turned out well because atheists now regularly give invocations at Greece town board meetings. We're becoming a part of the acknowledged community. So I think it's had some very good benefits.
In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Caroline Halter in Juneau, Annie Fight in Anchorage, Shayla Farzan in Homer, and Zachariah Hughes in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.